everyone, and welcome to Risky Business number 201. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's edition of the show is brought to you by Tenable Network Security. Big thanks to them. And this week, we're taking an in-depth look at Bitcoins, or Bitcoin. Most listeners would have heard of the fledgling online cryptocurrency by now, but there are a number of things that make Bitcoin extremely interesting. It's the world's first popular virtual cryptographically supported commodity, and once you wrap your head around it, it's very cool stuff, regardless of whether or not you think it has a future. I'll be joined by one of our regular guests, Sophos' Paul Ducklin, to talk about the Bitcoins after the news. In this week's sponsor interview, we're joined by Tenable Network Security's Brian Jericho Martin. He's stopping by to discuss the trojaning of the VSFTPD software. Some wise ass modified the source so anyone using a username against VSFTPD that contained a smiley face would spawn a shell on 6200. Very, very subtle stuff there. Brian joins us to talk about why you should always check your hashes or SIGs, you dummies. He also talks about his work with attrition.org, tracking Sony's latest woes over the last couple of months, tracking the old Sonage. That's all coming up after this week's feature interview. But before we get into all of that, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Boileau. And Adam, a big bit of news out of the UK. Rupert Murdoch has done his block over the whole voicemail hacking scandal, and he's actually closing his tabloid, The News of the World, over the scandal.
Yeah, it's an interesting outcome, eh? I mean, I followed briefly the discussions earlier on in the week when this was coming to light again. This is something we've seen discussed, a number of times over the last year or two.
Well, it's been going for about 5 years now, this whole thing.
Well, yeah, and I suppose there was, cell phone interception, before everything was all GSM and digital a while ago, and, tabloid papers are pretty good at weaseling their way into things. But yeah, it's sort of an interesting development, this. Like, it's a pretty big thing to turn around and kill, an enterprise of that size just like that. And I guess it's obviously there's other things involved, and it's not just about this. But yeah, it's a pretty strong sort of message to send people, eh?
Well, I think the message he's trying to send is to the government, and it's really because he's, Murdoch's trying to get his hands on all sorts of TV interests in the UK. What is incredible about this scandal, though, is just how political it got, and how there was, there's all this sort of implied, assumed sort of tolerance of these bad practices from the police and from politicians who were relying on Murdoch to sort of, write nice things about them and things like that. So it's, this whole scandal, as they say, can open worms everywhere. And I really think that, this is the only response that was actually available to Murdoch was to do something this radical so as to save his prospects for, acquiring various television interests in the UK that would require regulatory approval.
Yeah, and I guess it's also a pretty good smokescreen to detract from the actual individual people and the actual individual actions that people want to see some accountability for, whereas, this is a kind of a big thing, and this is what's getting the attention rather than, the specific cases that that we were previously discussing.
Well, I tell you one thing is that, it seemed that people in the UK were quite tolerant of this sort of thing when they were hacking into celebrities' voicemails and, hearing them talk about their affairs and whatever. But it's actually come to light more recently that a private eye working for the News of the World actually interfered with a police investigation by breaking into a British girl's, an apparent murder victim. I think she was missing. And, he broke into her voicemail, listened to the voicemails and deleted them and whatnot. And I think the family were given false hope because they could see that the voicemail had been accessed. So this is when I think the public's perception of this whole issue turned around, is when it turned out that, these guys were listening to the family's voicemail of murder victims and things like that. I mean, it's just unconscionable shit, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And this is definitely an example of something that, people are not going to be happy about, whereas it's much easier to feel less sorry for, Hugh Grant or, celebrities that are having their, salacious dirty laundry dragged out of their voicemail.
Now speaking of Hugh Grant, he actually wrote an article for the New Statesman. It's called The Bugger, Bugged. And I highly recommend checking it out. It's quite funny. Did you get a chance to have a read of it?
Yeah, I had a read through it, and it is quite entertaining. This Hugh Grant runs into this ex-News of the World paparazzi guy who eventually gives him a lift after his car's broken down, and they get to talking. And this guy comes out with a whole bunch of, you know, quite interesting revelations about the, you know, phone hacking and cell phone interception, the sort of things that the tabloid press have been doing. But of course, the funny thing is that Hugh Grant's recording it, and then wrote it up, with kind of transcripts in quite an entertaining article. And it's, you know, it's a good insight, into, you know, some of the technical aspects, but also, you know, some of the politics and the names that get dragged around and the relationships and things. So yeah, it's an interesting perspective on the story.
Well, and it's interesting too, what I found most interesting about it is it just is a transcript of his conversation that he recorded with this guy. What I found most interesting about it is it seems to ring true. It just has the air of being, you know, what this guy is talking about and the way that he's described this phone hacking thing being entrenched at News. You know, it seems believable, doesn't it? It really does have that authentic air.
Yeah, it does. I mean, the guy, you know, he comes across as the right sort of scoundrel. Like, he's not ashamed about himself. He doesn't appear like he's trying to hide anything. Like, he's not trying to make excuses for himself. And no. So it does. It comes across as quite believable. And that's, yeah, I guess that's what makes it an interesting article, because it does give you that kind of insight.
This bloke just reminds me of every tabloid guy I've ever met, you know. I've met a few. Woes for Rupert Murdoch continued also on July 4 as Fox News' Twitter account got hacked and someone posted a message there saying Barack Obama was dead.
Yeah, and this is one of a number of, you know, fairly high profile Twitter hacks over the last week or so. And yeah, it's quite entertaining. Of course, the funny thing is that Fox News didn't actually manage to delete the tweets for quite some time. And now they've been sort of thrashing about and flailing and trying to, you know, demand answers from Twitter, when clearly the finger is going to point way back into Fox and them having, you know, bad passwords or getting themselves owned and then subsequently the account compromised. Mm-hmm. But yeah, a bit of flailing, I guess.
When your password is George Bush and your Fox News, you know, it's kind of easy to guess.
Yeah, exactly. And we saw a bunch of the Fox passwords that were leaked when they got hacked a while ago, and they weren't very good, right? They didn't. I'm sure it's probably a different bit of Fox, but, you know, in terms of how their enterprise password policy is, it didn't look particularly good.
But you know what it's like, man? Like, I, you know, every girlfriend I've ever had, when I'm trying to help them out with something on their computer, and it's like, you know, what's your password? And they're just like, it's grape. Or, you know, just something completely insane. Like, anyway.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, there'd been a few high-profile Twitter compromises in the last week, one of which was actually the PayPal Twitter account, which is kind of lol.
Yeah, it is. So someone owned PayPal's Twitter and then posted links to paypalsucks.com. And a bunch of, you know, other things, bad-mouthing PayPal and telling people not to use it because they're jerks or whatever, which is entertaining. And then, you know, PayPal finally took control of it again and, you know, tried to apologize or something. But, yeah, it's, you know, people need to learn to, you know, given how, you know, how high-profile these things are, and the media covers people's Twitter accounts get known, right? You do kind of need to care, perhaps more than you have previously.
Well, I just think Twitter probably need to roll out some two-factor auth, you know? I mean, it would make sense because it's embarrassing to the company to have this sort of stuff happening.
Yeah, and I think that would be a pretty reasonable response. I'm sure they probably got something already underway.
A service they can offer as well, in terms of, like, they're already charging people for these verified accounts. I mean, why not chuck on an extra $10 a month? You know, plus a fee to actually get your token or your SMS or whatever. I mean, that could actually be a way for, you know, Twitter to actually make money. I mean, you know, for the first time in history, we could actually be seeing a business model that would actually benefit from security. You know what I mean?
Getting owned. Yeah. No, I like that. You should charge them royalties or something.
We'll see.
Yeah. Maybe they could pick up a bunch of really cheap secondhand RSA tokens.
Yes, there's a few of them floating around. Did you see there was a while ago, SC Magazine had SC Magazine in Australia had like a little photo gallery of alternative uses for expired RSA tokens. Like, you could use them as earrings or, you know. Yeah. That was quite funny. Now moving on to some bread and butter InfoSec story. This is hilarious, right? The whole jailbreaking culture that's popped up around Apple's iOS devices has actually brought to the fore a whole bunch of really good security researchers who don't actually know that they're security researchers. All they want to do is jailbreak these devices, and they keep finding these epic ODAs to do it with, you know, and then publishing them.
Well, yeah, it is very funny. Yeah, so this there's a new what they call a web-based jailbreak, i.e., remote codecs exploit. against modern iOS devices 4.3 and up. And yeah, like this guy is, you know, you go to his website and it'll jailbreak your iPhone for you, which is all very cool. Until you stop to think about the fact that this is genuine, legitimate, you know, remote code exec security research, and the guy's just dropped it in public, and that's quite funny. You know, it's a different twist on the classic full disclosure debate. But yeah, I'm sure these guys have a have a future in the infosec industry if they want one.
I think there were some guys who early on in this scene, you know, they just were not known for doing security research, and they just found all these awesome iOS bugs. You know. Moving on, and more Apple dramas. Anonymous reckons people declaring themselves as Anonymous have claimed to have stolen a bunch of login details to a server belonging to Apple.
Yeah, so they dropped, 26 logins and passwords? Not really the, you know, sort of hundred million sort of accounts we'd like to see compromised, I guess, to make it a bit more newsworthy. But, yeah, they appear to have owned something from Apple. And, I mean, realistically, given the size of Apple's network, I mean, what they're heading towards the size of Microsoft and Google in terms of amount of kit and stuff, not really surprising that something in there gets owned.
They probably took over the footy tipping server.
Yeah, but yeah, so it's not, I guess, not particularly exciting that people are dropping passwords on Pastebin. But I mean,
isn't it funny we're getting bored with this shit already? You know.
Yeah. It's like, get on with it.
Apple got owned, whatever. You know, like that's 2011, isn't it? That's where we've got to. Oh yeah, Apple got owned. Yeah. Next.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, speaking of Anonymous, and I found this a most intriguing story that was that appeared on zdnet.com.au, or ZDNet, as we like to call it. It was written by Luke Hopwell, one of our local journalists here in Australia. And he wrote that ANZ is actually ramping up its security efforts to counter the threats from groups like Anonymous and Lulzsec.
Which would be nice if they actually then went ahead and did meaningfully shore up their security measures, you know, rather than just talk about it. And obviously I've been around this industry long enough that I'm pretty cynical about, anyone who says that they're going to do something, that meaningfully improves their security when, we've all seen in the inside of, in the industry at least, has seen on the inside of big corporate and finance networks. And
I'm doing
a long way to go, buddy.
I'm doing recruitment, as you know, at the moment. Yeah. And it's just so hard to find good people that when an organization the size of ANZ says, we're going to improve our security, I'm thinking, where are you going to find these people to do that with? You know, that's one of the biggest issues facing the industry at the moment is the lack of good talent.
Yeah, absolutely. Would concur.
I mean, you can find testers, right? But finding one who will meaningfully improve the security of an organization like ANZ, that's going to be hard work.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, it is. And if we could find those people, we would hire them and probably hopefully pay them more than ANZ would.
Now, in the next yawner, 17,000 accounts and passwords, including U.S. military, login and passwords for this for some sort of website. Some guys called Connexion Hack Team published a list of these things, I think they actually came from some sort of military-focused media organization or something, but there's another 17,000 leaked emails and passwords. So 17,000, not so impressive. The Washington Post hack, which was just announced over the last few days, 1.27 million.
Okay, yeah, and that is a little bit better, I guess, in terms of numbers. But apparently this one was just email addresses rather than email addresses and passwords as well. Although I thought the write-up that we were reading from actually does make a very interesting point, which is that the people who are signed up for job hunting sites are probably much more vulnerable than average to spear phishing campaigns because, of course, they're looking for work or have recently been looking for work.
Yeah, we might have a job for you. Click here to have a look at it. And it is interesting too because we didn't actually mention at the outset that it wasn't the Washington Post per se. It was their job seeker jobs website component that actually got owned with 1.27 million accounts accessed. It's pretty serious business.
Yeah, and I think that community is probably more vulnerable than average, and that makes it kind of concerning. And of course, the Washington Post have come out and said that they care about your personal data and they'll do their best to secure it, et cetera, et cetera. Same thing that everybody says every time before they get owned. After they get owned, sorry. It'd be nice if they did it before. I suppose like ANZ, perhaps.
Now, just very quickly, because we're discussing this one in this week's sponsor interview with Brian Jericho Martin from Tenable, but the VSFTPD daemon, the VSFTP daemon, was backdoored and offered for download, which was kind of serious business. Check your hashes, people. Check your SIGs.
Yeah, although this one, fortunately, was only backdoored for for a couple of days or something. But yeah, and not a particularly subtle backdoor like the PHP WordPress ones we saw last week. But it is kind of funny given the reputation of VSFTPD.
Yeah, anyone putting a smiley face in their login name would actually cause the process to spawn a shell on 6200. which is like, yeah, kind of sticks out. Now a little bit of malware news, and this one's kind of funny because even if it is hype and even if it's not quite true, it just made for such a bloody good headline, which is that there's a new indestructible botnet comprised of 4.5 million hosts, and the guys at Kaspersky Lab are actually jumping up and down about this one and saying that it's pretty serious business.
Yeah, so this is, it's certainly evolutionary rather than revolutionary in terms of malware engineering. But this particular botnet seems to be quite cunning in terms of how it encrypts its communication to the command and control servers. They're, as I gather, it's keyed based on the name of the kind of FastFlux DNS CNC servers they're using, and then the traffic is exchanged over an existing public peer-to-peer network rather than them trying to roll their own, which, you know, those are both fairly clever engineering moves, and, you know, they do seem to it will help the longevity of this particular botnet. I also thought it was interesting that they are selling, like, you can buy a subscription service to proxy through their botnet for anonymity, which I think, it seems like quite a reasonable business model.
It's $100 a month, and you can just, like, use their botnet to as, like, a criminal tour.
Yeah, well, exactly, which is quite cunning, really.
It's very cunning. But, I mean, are you really going to trust those guys? You know what I mean?
No. I mean, of course, you're not going to run your traffic in the clear over their network. But if you're trying to achieve anonymity, then
so you'd probably tour into it and then out and then maybe tour it again and then.
Yeah, I mean, this you would use this as a chain of things to bounce around through them. And you use, you know, one particular bit of the chain, you're worried about the anonymity. Another bit, you're probably worried about the confidentiality, that sort of thing.
Okay, now ready a shot and drink, because Microsoft is plugging 22 holes in the upcoming Patch Tuesday.
Yep, and one of them's rated critical, three important, which actually this seems lower than usual, but I guess we're still drinking. There's what, bugs in Visio?
Vista
critical
and 7.
Critical patch dresses, yeah, Vista and 7, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, patch your staff. You must be used to this by now.
Yes, I think we are, but it's always worth mentioning, you know, just a journal of record. Yeah. Journal of record there, Adam.
At the very least, we get to drink.
Now, this one is kind of interesting because it's all about Chrome OS, Google's, you know, operating system. It's a Linux-based operating system, I believe. Chrome OS apparently has some issues.
Yeah, so this is an interesting write-up, and it's a discussion of a guy who's got a talk coming up at the next Black Hat discussing vulnerabilities in Chrome OS. And it kind of feels like it's been spun for, you know, for attention for his talk, and it may have been spun a little more than he intended, but the basic gist of it is that because Chrome OS is, you know, your interface is through a browser, your applications that you're going to use that aren't already web-based, you're going to get through some kind of browser extension, which in the case of Chrome is not quite the same as a regular, traditional FAT browser extension like we're used to in Firefox. But essentially the gist of it is that because these Chrome extension apps are, you know, basically web applications, they're vulnerable to all the same sorts of bug classes that we would expect. That we're real web applications, cross-site requests, forgery, cross-site scripting, script injection layer, all that sort of thing.
But he did find actually some specific issues, didn't he?
Yeah, and he did find some specific issues. And I think it got spun more into this is your architectural flaws with Chrome OS.
Rather than this is the sort of research that's going to be done against sort of web-based cloud OSs in the future.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, way to miss the point, jerks. We should mention too that that's Matt Johansson of White Hat Security. So those guys are kind of known for knowing a bit about cross-site request forgery and those sorts of things. And finally, Adam, there's been another attack against a United States Energy Department laboratory. It's the Pacific Northwest National Lab and Jefferson National Lab. They were actually taken down in the aftermath of what has been described as sophisticated attacks. They actually pulled the plug on their website, internet access and email access. And the funny part is when it all came back up, they said, look, we only do about 20%. 20% of our work is classified. The rest of it is open and none of the classified stuff got touched that we know of. But, you know, do you really know, dudes?
Yeah, step one, class this attack as sophisticated. Sure, right, yeah. Step two, they shut it down quickly. Sure. I'm sure they spotted it very promptly. And, of course, three, yes, they have a really clear idea of what happened and can say for sure that no classified information was lost. Usual horseshit there, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. But we don't know. I mean, we don't know what the inside of their network looks like. For all we know, they're running really good network separation on their classified bits and the attack was stopped. But it's just interesting to see more news that indicates that organizations doing energy research in the United States have been continuously targeted by sophisticated adversaries.
Yeah, it's probably fair to say that everything's being targeted by sophisticated adversaries, and these guys happen to notice, or, you know, their adversaries weren't quite so sophisticated and screwed up.
They've actually tuned their IDS or something, you know?
Yeah, they accidentally left it on. Oops, our bad.
Adam, that's it for this week's news. Thank you very much for joining us, as always, and we'll chat to you again next week.
And cheers, Pat. See you then.
Adam, Mr. Beardy Guy, boileau, with a look at the week's news headlines there. Now, before we get into this week's feature interview, it's time for me to have a bit of a whinge, a bit of a sook. For the last several weeks, I've been advertising a job in Sydney on this podcast. It's a great job. It's working with a global, very well-respected security firm. It pays up to 140 grand a year plus bonuses, plus super, plus 5 weeks a year annual leave. There's working from home options, a bit of travel, a bit of on-site. The management team here in Australia are exceptional. It's a rolled gold 24-carat awesome opportunity, and I've had bugger all response. So really ask yourself, do you really love your job that much that you're not even prepared to see what else is out there? You know, if you're a web app tester, you're based in Sydney, you want to know more about this job, in complete confidence, email me on patrick@risky.biz or call me on 0411 696 384. But yeah, just get in touch. It's not going to hurt to find out a little bit more about this job. Anyway, done sooking, done whinging. It is time for this week's feature interview now, and we are chatting with Paul Ducklin, who works for Sophos, and we're chatting to him all about Bitcoins. Bitcoin has been in the news lately, big time. It first hit the headlines in a meaningful way, in a massive way, when Wired.com ran a feature about a website called Silk Road that sells all sorts of illegal stuff over the internet, and it accepts Bitcoins as payment. Then Lulzsec started accepting Bitcoin donations, and then a guy claimed to have had $500,000 of the virtual currency stolen from his computer. A Bitcoin exchange, Mt. Gox, was hacked, and thus the whole issue of Bitcoin these days in media is very, very hip. So hip, in fact, that I was actually being quizzed by a mainstream journalist about Bitcoin recently, and they asked me a bunch of stuff that I couldn't really answer. So I got in touch with Paul Ducklin, who loves stuff like this, and I asked him a bunch of questions he couldn't answer. So Paul and I have basically spent the last few days reading up on Bitcoins. And I even had a chat. I got in touch with the developers list and wound up chatting with a guy, a Swedish guy named Stefan Thomas, who works on BitcoinJS.org. And I got to say, it's really interesting stuff. Big thanks to Stefan, too, for going over a lot of this stuff where I had questions. Now, if you don't know what Bitcoin is, it is at once an incredibly simple idea and a ridiculously complicated alternative cryptographic commodity and currency. Bitcoin is, in essence, a peer-to-peer digital currency unit supported by the Bitcoin open source software. Bitcoins are created or mined by solving cryptographic problems using processing power, and each Bitcoin itself is divisible to 8 decimal places. Vector-based processors like a graphics card or gaming console are the most effective for Bitcoin mining because you're trying to, you know, brute force a hash, basically. But the basic idea is that you have your computer chugging away trying to, you know, brute force a hash or something like that in order to create the virtual coin. Then voila, you have a Bitcoin that you can spend or trade. And I think at the moment a single Bitcoin is worth something in the order of 17 US dollars. Now, if that weren't enough to bake your noodle already, cryptographically generated or mined currency, it actually gets better. You don't actually need an account to trade Bitcoins. It's a cryptographically engineered, decentralized currency. All you need is a public-private key pair. So if you want to trade Bitcoins for cash just to buy them, you can through an exchange. So it's a bit similar in that regard to eGold, but unlike eGold, there's no central authority. So in this case, possession isn't 9/10 of the law, it's 10/10 of the law. Now, there's a bunch of things that make Bitcoin worth discussing and worth dedicating a show to. Firstly, there's the whole idea of creating a cryptographically generated token that's supposed to hold value. I mean, that's intriguing in itself. And it kind of makes sense because, you know, anything that requires that much computational intensity to generate does kind of, you know, you can imagine how that has value attached to it. But it's still something to wrap your head around. And then there's the fact that the Bitcoin software is hard-coded to only ever allow 21 million coins within the next few decades, which makes Bitcoin, you know, more like a finite commodity than a traditional inflationary fiat currency. So when the last Bitcoin is mined, what will happen? Will people start hoarding Bitcoins because demand for them pushes the price up? Will there be a deflationary spiral as people delay spending their Bitcoins because they're appreciating? Will there be currency hoarding? Unlike gold, Bitcoins don't actually have any intrinsic value. Will hoarding lead to merchants moving to another currency? Could other fiat-style inflationary currencies be created with Bitcoin backing, sort of like the gold standard? Could Bitcoin become a virtual commodity? Now, as Bitcoin is completely decentralized, no reserve bank controls it, so they can't print more of it, which is what they call quantitative easing in our traditional monetary systems. They can't do that. So if this sort of idea takes off, does it have potential to fundamentally transform monetary systems? Or will governments move to destroy currencies and commodities like Bitcoin before they can take root? There are also a whole bunch of security, privacy, and anonymity issues that Paul and I will get into. But it's safe to say that Bitcoin is just this bizarre combination of genius and stupidity. It's just like a real monetary system. Paul joins me now to discuss Bitcoin. Paul, do you agree with that assessment that Bitcoin is at once equal parts genius and equal parts just, you know, daffy?
I think that's a lovely way to put it, and I wish I'd thought of it myself. It's an attempt to provide a mechanism for barter or online trade which provides at least some anonymity and supposedly suppresses any ability for central control or recording of who bought what from whom when, meaning there are no records that anyone can surveil or, worse, lose in some kind of data intrusion find on Anonymous's website tomorrow.
Well, I don't know if that's entirely true because it is a fairly traceable system, but you are entirely correct when you say that it's a decentralized system. And I suppose one of the most intriguing things about Bitcoin as a concept is you don't even need an account to actually either generate or trade Bitcoins, do you? It is an entirely peer-to-peer based cryptographic system. It's quite clever.
Yes, and that's why I say its idea is to provide at least a pseudo-anonymous cypherpunk solution to, as I say, bartering and trading online in a way which is much less traceable than having a central authority which decides whether you're worth giving credit to, whether your data should be sold to a third party, and so forth. So as you say, it's a great idea to try something like this and try it practically in the real world. It's also, of course, a self-limiting experiment because the rate at which bitcoins can be minted or made cryptographically will die off exponentially over time. So eventually the experiment will come to an end with a finite number of bitcoins.
Well, that's a whole other interesting component to this because it makes bitcoins more like a commodity than like an actual currency. Currencies are inflationary. So you've got your dollars. Governments can print dollars. They can set interest rates on them and stuff like that to encourage people to spend them. But as you say, there's a finite amount of bitcoins. It's hard-coded into the software that there will never be any more than 21 million bitcoins. Now, you'd think that would actually, if there is still demand for bitcoins, that's actually going to push the prices up. And it's going to discourage people from spending them, which means you get like a deflationary spiral as everyone hoards the currency and eventually people stop accepting it and it crashes.
Well, Patrick, praise the Lord, I'm not an economist, so I actually don't know whether being deflationary or inflationary is good, bad, or indifferent. It certainly seems that there are potentially significant problems with both. And being non-deflationary, for example, living in Zimbabwe a few years ago, you'd probably have been crying out for a little bit of deflation. And it took a radical intervention, basically disowning one's own currency, to sort that mess out at all. So I don't really know whether, as I say, that's good, bad, or indifferent. It's certainly different.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? It's a completely sort of constructed commodity. It's not like gold, which still has intrinsic value, but it is like gold in that it is a finite, or I suppose, you know, we're still pulling gold out of the ground, but it is a finite resource. And, you know, I was having a chat with this guy, this Swedish guy, Stefan Thomas, who develops Bitcoin-related software. And he was saying, well, look, when we run out of bitcoins, when there are no more bitcoins to be mined, what's to stop someone creating another online currency, which is an inflationary currency backed by bitcoins, sort of like the gold standard? So you sort of wonder, I mean, it's a crazy idea, but it's nothing crazier than what we're seeing in traditional monetary systems.
And it's certainly no crazier than the idea that one can buy things like the right to display a number plate. In New South Wales, I think the number single-digit number plates can go for hundreds of thousands of dollars. You never own them. You you earn the right to display them on your car, whereas you could just paint that number on your car if you really wanted people to see it. So there are weirder things. Domain names, for example, they don't really exist. You just get the right to make it resolve in DNS, and yet they seem to be an inflationary currency, and we're about to see a whole tranche more with ICANN's announcement that you'll be able to have any top-level domain you want if you cough up $185,000.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's look back on... I mean, Bitcoin, really, I hadn't heard of it until a couple of months ago, until Lulzsec started soliciting donations via Twitter openly, and that obviously piqued the interest of a lot of people, particularly in media. But we've really seen it take off lately. Walk us through some of the major Bitcoin-related events that we've seen.
Well, it is funny, isn't it? Lulzsec, we're going to take Bitcoins. People started noticing. The media started writing about it. And that prompted a whole load of other outings, if you like, of the currency, which seemed to have really spiked interest in it and a lot to make it a tradable market. Ones that I'm aware of is the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, announced that it would no longer accept Bitcoins because it felt that that would make it hard for it to comply with the laws of oversight, because although it is libertarian-leaning, it wishes to comply with the law. A couple of US senators are in high dudgeon about it and want Bitcoin banned. I don't know how you ban something that doesn't really exist and is completely decentralized, if you like, but they've seen it being used in the US for a website called Silk Road, where you can buy all sorts of dangerous stuff like marijuana. The ABC here in Australia apparently caught out one of its IT staff using spare capacity on their server racks to generate bitcoins that presumably this person, he or she, intended to use for their own personal gain, which of course didn't please the IT department terribly much. And we had the leading exchange, that's where you swap bitcoins with other people and can cash them in and out, actually had an enormous implosion where the street value of bitcoins dropped from about $17 to one US cent in about 60 seconds and needed a very non-libertarian, non-peer-to-peer, non-unregulated approach to fix. They basically rewound time and pretended that all the dodgy transactions never happened.
Well, that run on bitcoins was actually caused by some sort of security incident, wasn't it? There was a breach?
Supposedly. But the whole idea, you'd hope, of a currency of this sort is you shouldn't be able to tell. So that does raise some questions about the true anonymity of it. If it is truly anonymous, then if someone steals your password, that's independent of the way that the Bitcoin algorithm and economy is supposed to work. Perhaps if Bitcoin were true libertarian currency, then that would be your problem. But it turns out that the exchanges that merely facilitate trades in this algorithmic stuff don't operate that way. They operate in a way which is very much closer to the way that traditional closed exchanges like ASX and NASDAQ operate.
Well, they have to be, because they're the interface between the Bitcoin economy and the real world economy. So there's this weird sort of interface between the traditional monetary system and this virtual monetary system, which I find quite interesting. But you're right, they are a weak point.
And you're right that that interface is the tricky part, because if you're aiming to have a cypherpunk, pseudo-anonymous, international digital currency, but the only way you can actually get people in and out of it is to let them trade with real currencies, then certainly at those interfaces, a lot of the complexity lies. Because if governments wish to regulate this, short of illegalizing the use of Bitcoin software or the algorithms at all, which I'd imagine in the US would be well nigh impossible, I guess the way to do it is, you say you can do what you like with lumps of bits that you circulate online. What you can't do is trade them in and out of our fiat currency without the oversight that is expected of any other bank.
Well, it's quite impossible to do that sort of regulation. I mean, we saw e-gold was almost a similar model, in that you could buy gold through a broker, through an exchange. You could buy gold with e-gold that they would hold for you, and then you could transfer e-gold around in that system, and then you could pop it out at exchanges. And again, they were non-reversible transactions, which made them quite popular with the bad guys. These days, people are using stuff in Russia like web money. It's actually become quite a widely accepted currency. And indeed, web money offers banking services in Russia that are considered in some parts of the country to be considerably more reliable than those offered by traditional banks. And this is why I feel, Paul, that governments will move to regulate something like Bitcoin is because it has, well, perhaps not Bitcoin itself, but an idea like Bitcoin actually has the potential to become a viable traded alternate currency. And if you've got an alternate viable tradable currency that isn't controllable by a central federal reserve or anything like that, governments don't like that because they're ceding control of the monetary system to a bunch of crypto dorks.
Taxation offices like it even less because it means you never actually get money in any taxable form or sell it in any taxable form. And it's interesting, a decade or so ago when I was living in the UK, the area where I lived had quite an active barter currency. I forget the name of it. I think they were called stones. And the idea was, I needed a plumber. You're a plumber. It's going to cost about 100 quid. So you come and fix it. And so I kind of owe you roughly £100 worth of work. So next time you need Linux installed on a server or you need virus cleaning done on your computer, that's my expertise. I come and refund you in kind. And of course, the taxation office didn't like that kind of thing at all, particularly when it was formalized to make it to give it a much bigger reach than if it was just neighbors helping each other out, because they're not getting any tax or any sales tax or value added tax, goods and services tax on any of those transactions. So it's completely outside their system. And in the end, they introduced regulations that said if you want to join one of these barter schemes, then you have to allow it to be taxed in a way that is similar or equivalent to the sort of taxation regime you'd have if you were using regular money. So you're right, they probably will find a way when they have the will to do so. And I guess something like that will end up applying to Bitcoin. How easily you can enforce it is another story. But as for regulating it, I guess if you say, yeah, use Bitcoin all you like and anonymously send us taxation money, I'm sure that the taxation office would find that very satisfactory.
Now, another thing that I find really interesting about this stuff is what piqued my interest is when the Lulzsec guys were soliciting those donations publicly. They're like, this is our Bitcoin address. And that's when I got reading about it. And I'm like, well, yeah, you don't actually need to set up an account. You just have a public-private key pair. You create a wallet and you get a whole bunch of addresses to which you can get money sent to you in the form of Bitcoins. And that got me thinking, well, okay, is this stuff completely untraceable? How does one actually then go about using that money as an instrument? How do you go about buying goods and services? Now, you can actually do that quite easily and quite anonymously. The problem is that all of those transactions are traceable from one address to the other. And because it is a peer-to-peer network, every transaction is actually broadcast to every node, which makes the whole idea of anonymity, I mean, it is anonymous in the sense that you're not creating an account and it's not tied to an identity, but people will know that money that went in the form of Bitcoins to that address controlled by Lulzsec, they will be able to see where those Bitcoins went from that address. If that makes sense. They will be able to see which point those coins went to next. So if they go to a online poker site and spend some money in an attempt to launder the money and lose the cash in a poker game to another account that they've set up and then withdraw it out, I mean, all someone would need to do is get into that poker website, look at the logs, and they'd be able to figure out pretty quickly where that money went, and they'd be able to tie it to an identity. So while it is anonymous, it is completely and entirely traceable, isn't it?
Patrick, I think saying completely traceable is, that's probably putting it a little strongly. I think it's fair to say that there is, that by design inside the crypto system it uses, there is a chain of history in terms of cryptographic public keys of which key pair actually signed, if you like, owned the currency at every stage in the transaction. That prevents you doing replay attacks where you just spend the same money several times. So that's an important part of the cryptography. But as you say, if you use the same key pair for many different bitcoins and lots of different transactions, then at least that says to someone who wishes to observe you that the same thing, person, group is doing the same thing over and over again. So imagine when you spend a banknote, every time a banknote comes into your possession, your name gets written on it in indelible ink. And when you give it to the next guy, his name is written on it in indelible ink, and so forth and so forth and so forth. So for every cash banknote circulating in Australia, there's a list of whoever had it and the next person they spent it with or gave it to, right? Let's imagine that in my analogy that the bank that banknote history is publicly available. The point is, anyone who steals your wallet and gets all your cash out of it or steals a bunch of wallets will get a whole load of transaction history. So if cash worked like that, it would obviously be a hell of a lot less anonymous than it is now. However, it would still not be possible to say at each stage what you spent it on. So there would be more anonymity than in a conventional credit card-like or bank-like transaction.
Oh, I absolutely agree. Right? But say that you actually use some of those notes, or you know, you use some of those bitcoins, and okay, so authorities can see that the Lulzsec guys spent some of their bitcoins, gave some of their bitcoins to this other Bitcoin account, which might be tied to a legitimate business or an exchange. Then they can go and they can maybe, you know, shake out some details or something. So I guess the point I'm making is that it is anonymous, but it's not untraceable.
And to continue my analogy, my idea is that from the Australian banknotes with everyone's name who it's ever passed through written on, well, the analogy is it's actually a little safer than that, because the name written on is whatever the person who had it felt like using as their name at the time. So they could call themselves Sir Henry Parkes, which is very convenient because his name's already on one of our banknotes. And they could, with some limitations, use a different name every time, but they might get careless and not do so. So in a way, tracing this stuff is a little bit like watching net flows on a network. In other words, you can certainly do traffic analysis, although you don't actually know what was being trafficked in across the network. The other thing to remember, of course, is that some of the people along the way may not have had your best interests of pseudo-anonymity at heart, and they may be actually keeping very careful logs of the exact identity of anyone they passed the cash on to whenever they could do so, which means that you are leaving behind a sort of reminiscent vapor trail.
And it's like a point-in-time record, isn't it?
Yeah. So, of course, there are ways of taking this system, which is by design not guaranteed to be completely anonymous, and introducing anonymity. For example,
well, it'd be piss easy to set up a laundering scheme for something like this. You know, you'd just have some sort of website where, you know, which would generate key pairs and, you know, take payments from you, take payments from this other guy, and then sort of mix up the coins and, you know, issue them back out to whatever new key pairs they create. I guess, you know, I just got hung up on the idea of anonymity because I just find it fascinating that you've got a traceable anonymous system. And it all kind of makes sense in this really crazy way.
I wouldn't like to be the person who has to try and go backwards or forwards in a bunch of Bitcoin transactions.
I do want to talk about the mining of Bitcoins, actually, because it turns out it's you're trying to like break a hash or something, aren't you, to actually generate a Bitcoin. You need to solve a cryptographic problem, is that right?
Yes, very loosely speaking, to get to the next stage of the puzzle, which means that you actually may generate some of this imaginary wealth. Very loosely speaking, you need to find input data based on a starting point by adding some random stuff, which produces a SHA-hash, which has a certain number of zero bits at the beginning. And obviously the probability of doing that on every try is 1/2 to the number of zero bits you need at the beginning. And by continually increasing in the challenge the number of zero bits that are needed, it gets harder and harder over time to uncover Bitcoins. And that's why the total number of Bitcoins in circulation eventually tapers off.
Well, and it sort of counters Moore's law as well, doesn't it? Because as computers get faster, you know, the difficulty of creating a Bitcoin gets harder.
That's the idea. My understanding is at least part of that procedure. Firstly, it was to provide a closed box, a limited size for the total experiment, which prevents this inflationary craze or someone just going, okay, well, we'll extend the currency arbitrarily. So it prevents someone exerting that sort of control over it. But it does mean that it's getting ever harder to solve each problem. And in fact, the miners, so-called Bitcoin miners who've been attracted to Bitcoins because of all the publicity we talked about earlier, have pretty much given up on regular CPUs and are switching to GPUs.
Well, for any sort of problem like that, you're going to use a vector-based processor, aren't you? Because the instructions allow for these sorts of factoring things. I mean, it's, you know, that's what our buddy Nick did with the PS3 and using that to crack password hashes back in the day.
I haven't heard of anyone renting time on a PS3 botnet.
This is the thing, isn't it? A PS3 botnet Because I'm told that if you've got a really high-end GPU cranking 24/7, you might be putting out like $50 in bitcoins a week, right?
Yes.
So maybe if you could actually assemble a botnet of PS3s or even of gaming machines or whatever, if you could take them over, using your botnet to mine bitcoins could become a tidy little profitable enterprise, couldn't it?
Let's hope it stays that way. Just a could be, certainly. Or if you're in charge of a render farm, which is very good at doing this sort of calculation but for other purposes, and you think that your employer isn't tending it carefully enough and there's plenty of spare CPU power and you decide to borrow some of it, you could mint bitcoins that technically and legalistically don't belong to you at all. And indeed, that's what happened to the poor chap at the, in the IT department at the ABC in Sydney. He was caught doing just that in slack time on servers in a server rack.
Paul Ducklin, that's all we're going to have time for, mate. Thank you so much for joining us for a little bit of a navel-gazing exercise involving the humble little cryptocurrency, the Bitcoin.
Thanks, Patrick.
Paul Ducklin with a chat about Bitcoins there. Up next, it's time for this week's sponsor interview. And as you heard in the news, the VSFTPD software was Trojaned over the last week. So if you installed the Trojan version, then basically anyone can get a shell on your box by using a smiley face in their login name. That'll spawn a shell on 6200 and Bob's your mother's brother. Done. So we're going to chat about that now with Brian Jericho Martin. He works for Tenable Network Security, one of Risky Business's most staunch and long-term supporters. Without companies like Tenable Network Security supporting us, there's no podcast. So big thanks to them. And that's why every week we let our sponsors come onto the show so that you may know how very, very clever they are. Brian Martin is well known through his work with attrition.org and OSVDB, the open source vulnerability database. He joins me now to discuss the VSFTPD issue and why it is a good reminder that you should always check your hashes and SIGs when you're installing stuff. He's also going to tell us about his work tracking the Sonage, tracking all of the mayhem inflicted on Sony by Anon et al. Over the last couple of months. But first, let's talk about VSFTPD. And Brian, it seems that this was a pretty half-assed and easy-to-spot Trojan attempt. Would you agree with that?
Right. Not only was it easy to spot as far as looking at the code, but as far as an effective backdoor, apparently there was no method for a backdoored copy or installation to send out a notice to anyone. So for the person whoever backdoored it, for them to find an installation would be very difficult.
Okay, well, I suppose the interesting part of this story is that, it seems that now that package managers do a lot of the hash checking and signature checking on, on packages like FTP, daemons and stuff, it seems that people have sort of got out of the habit of actually checking hashes and signatures on the stuff that they download. Do you think that's a fair statement?
No, because I don't think that people were ever in the habit to begin with. The mechanism's always been there, but the amount of people that will actually check a signature for a package or even checking signatures of PGP keys and messages, it's been pretty rare.
It's a pretty common thing, though, isn't it, for particularly open source packages to be, probably because they're available from so many different places, it's quite common for Trojan versions to pop up here and there, isn't it?
Yes. Looking through a history, there's some 39 or 40 incidents that we know about dating back to 1994.
So would you recommend then that any CSOs listening would, dust off their security policy and maybe add something to it along the lines of always check hashes and SIGs? I mean, or would you think that's a standard item in most security policies that just gets ignored?
Actually, it's probably not part of a specific policy. And if it was there, I don't think it would necessarily do any good. It's just something that an administrator or a security admin has to get in the habit of doing. It just needs to be part of a good security practice when installing software. And of course, when you check the signature, you have to consider where it's coming from. If you're getting the actual package and the signature from the same server, then matching it doesn't mean much.
No, it doesn't. You're right. But I mean, obviously those signatures are available usually from multiple sources, right?
Right. So if you're looking at multiple sources and you find two different signatures, that alone is a warning flag and, have to be careful. But otherwise, for smaller distributions, it's common for them to have one distribution point, one server where they distribute the software and the signature.
One thing that really surprised me, actually, is I remember some time ago, a friend of mine just sort of IMing me and saying they downloaded a package of blah, blah, blah of X, and they'd they'd seen that the hash didn't match, and they said, well, you know, I just didn't install it. I figure it's probably been Trojan. And then I think it popped up in the news something like 10 days later, and this was a fairly commonly used piece of software. I can't recall precisely what it was. So it seems that people really, really aren't in the habit of checking these things, even on major distributions. And I got to say, at the time, I found that quite surprising. I mean, would it surprise you that it would take 10 days to find, you know, that sort of problem with a very popular bit of software?
Not at all. I believe that one of the distributions actually lasted for some 2 to 3 months. As far as the one you're talking about, that could have been ProFTP, which was backdoored in December. You know, that's a large distribution. Their official server was the one that was compromised, and the backdoor software was downloaded from that.
So, you know, but really what I'm asking, Brian, is what do you think organizations can do to ensure that their admins actually pay attention to this sort of stuff? I mean, is it a case where you could introduce some sort of checklist process for installing software? I mean, I know it's a major hassle.
Well, that's what I was saying. It needs to become part of their routine. It needs to become a habit.
Mm.
You know, it's like brushing your teeth. You need to check signatures for anything you download and install on your network.
Mm-mm. But I mean, do you think it should get to the point where people need to actually, you know, sign a sheet of paper? They tick a box and sign a sheet of paper saying, you know, I've checked the hash. I mean, should there be that sort of level of checklist, or is that just needless paperwork?
It may actually help some organizations. It may be needless in others. It really just depends on the size of the organization. If there's other precautions put in place, you know, if multiple people check an installation or the installation process.
So some sort of redundancy you think would be helpful.
Right. So if you have a single admin, perhaps using a piece of paper and a checklist is good. Or if you have multiple people on your team, just having someone sanity check the work you're about to do and to make sure that the file you downloaded is, you know, the one that was intended.
Okay, Brian, while we've got you on the line, I thought it might be worth having a bit of a chat about some of the work you've been doing with attrition.org, particularly around tracking what got called sonage out there, which was obviously every man and his dog taking over various Sony websites and online properties. You put together a pretty comprehensive sort of attribution list of who did what to which Sony property, didn't you?
Yeah, it's basically an incident list that has the date, the site, what happened, what data was compromised, and also has a convenient list of the stock price for the given day.
Do you actually track who claimed credit for each incident?
Where it's known, yes.
And the method of entry?
Where we know it, yes.
And, you know, what did we really learn from that whole thing? Was it like, numerous groups using numerous methods? Was it numerous groups using, you know, a couple of methods? Was it just free for all? Like what did the whole pain that Sony experienced look like from a high level?
From a high level, there were at least 5 different intruders, as many as, you know, 15. They used a variety of attacks, originally started out with distributed denial of service. Then it moved on to some other kind of intrusion. Eventually, it became more standard web defacements and SQL injection attacks.
And was there anything exotic used? Because it seems like these guys were using an awful lot of PHP file include and you know, SQL injection and sort of boring stuff like that.
For most of it that happened later, no, it seemed very run-of-the-mill. The original attacks against the PlayStation network, that's still unknown. That could have been something more complex.
What's your gut feeling on that? Do you think that was a recreational attack? Because at the time that happened, that was my gut feeling. I just felt that it was too interesting an attack to have been criminals who are, you know, still got heaps of easy targets that are vulnerable to really easy stuff.
I would guess that it was still someone either affiliated with or loosely affiliated with Anonymous. I have a feeling that they thought, hey, we'll try to go after Sony some more. We'll try to break in. They realized, you know, once they got going that, hey, this is easy, or, you know, they had a stroke of good luck. Next thing you know, they popped them and 77 million customer records were exposed.
But it doesn't seem like that information was actually used in any sort of fraudulent activity, does it?
No. So far, there's no evidence of that. And Anonymous did deny involvement in the hack. But as I said, Anonymous is really kind of a big nebulous group, and someone that may see themselves affiliated with it could have been responsible.
Well, it's not even a group, is it? It's just a name that you use when you don't want something attributed to you.
Well, I think it's both. You know, there is definitely a solid core of them. They are anonymous. They are kind of a defined group. But then they also seem to accept, appreciate, or encourage people to take on the name if it matches their cause.
Yeah, which also helps obfuscate the identities of any particular groups that are, you know.
Oh, yes. It's a very effective way of operating. You know, it makes it considerably more difficult for anyone trying to follow them, whether it's law enforcement or a private admin or whatever else. You know, it just adds way too many variables to make it easy to find them.
Now, has all this zonage stuff and all of the Lulzsec-inspired stuff and this anti-sec stuff, has it settled down? Because it appears to be settling down, and all of the stuff that we've seen leaked under the anti-sec banner lately looks quite lame, to be honest. Some of it, just recently they released a whole bunch of data from the Australian Electoral Commission, which is, you know, very interesting, and there's some guys doing some interesting stuff mining it, but it's all publicly available information. They also broke into the Mosman, you know, someone broke into the Mosman City Council, which is like a municipal government in Sydney, and, you know, dumped a bunch of documents from there that, you know, didn't really contain anything interesting. Have things quietened down in your view?
Overall, no. If you look at the past 7 to 14 days, the amount of attacks, at least under the anti-sec movement, have been consistent. There's several a day, you know, but once again, because there's so many people that are contributing to it, and it's not just anonymous or just Lulzsec. Yeah, it's a lot of small incidents, but as you kind of suggested, many of them seem to be low-hanging fruit. They seem to be real easy attacks, you know.
Targets of opportunity, you'd think.
Yeah, target of opportunity for sure.
Now, there's probably some people listening to this podcast who wouldn't remember anti-sec the first time it came round. Anti-sec sort of, what was it, late 90s, early 2000s, and anti-sec now seems to be a pretty different sort of thing, doesn't it?
Right. It was originally in 1999, kind of the same overtone. You know, we were against security, we were against white hats. It lasted, I want to say, for a year or two, kind of got revamped several years later. And now, once again, people have picked up the anti-sec torch.
Yeah, but it doesn't quite have the same feel. I mean, you know, anti-sec back then, Project Mayhem, all of that, had the feel of like a zero for owned sort of operation, not so much a, you know, let's attack municipal governments sort of operation.
Right.
I mean, it seemed to be very, originally, it seemed to be very tightly focused on anyone who was profiting from the so-called, you know, security industry, which of course back then was a relatively, very new industry. How do we explain that shift?
Right. Originally, anti-sec was anti-security industry more than anti-security. And the people that have picked up the torch recently are more just anti-security, going after anything and everything they can. I would actually guess that most of the people doing it now have no idea about the history of the anti-sec term.
Okay, Brian Martin, that's all we're going to have time for. Thank you so much for joining us on Risky Business.
Anytime.
Brian Jericho Martin of Tenable Network Security there with this week's sponsor interview. And that rounds out this week's edition of the show. This week's track is another one by Marshall and the Fro, because I'm running out of indie artists. But this one is called Tall Poppies, and you can get it on iTunes. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray.
Welcome.
Thanks for listening.
To this town of tall, with secrets are shared. Tall poppies grow, people hear. They know my name, stories don't change. Faces they aged into long, and whispers I hear, the garden is speaking, with green eyes and fear, with your words, you tell of your faith, the grapevine had bit ya, and left you his stains, and tall poppies grow just as high as they can, why can't I go?
week. We didn't go back and hit the... there's one story we missed, I think. Oh, actually, no, we did cover it. That's all right. I was just going to... I made a mental note to make fun of Darren Pawley for calling Pastebin a cyber locker, and then I forgot to do that. Fuck, it's a cyber locker.